Hello, this is Barbara Van Dalen. Thank you for joining me today on Inner Space. Inner Space is a special program that helps us pay attention to our own emotional health and well-being and the health and well-being of those we love. For this episode of Inner Space, we're talking about suicide, a subject that is painful for those who have been directly affected and for those who worry about loved ones who are struggling with depression and suicidal ideation. For those who haven't been touched by suicide, it's something that they may not like to think about because it's a scary topic. But this is something that we must talk about so that we're better educated, more compassionate, and better able to help those who are hurting and feeling hopeless. First, I talk with Dr. Jennifer Ashton, who you may recognize from her appearances on Good Morning America. Sadly, in 2017, Jennifer experienced the loss of a loved one by suicide. She's written an important book to help survivors of suicide heal and joined us to talk about her journey. Then I sit down with Dr. Keita Franklin, the National Director of Suicide Prevention for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, whose entire career, first with the Department of Defense and now at the VA, has been devoted to saving the lives of those who serve and our veterans. Both of these guests are so caring and so knowledgeable. We're fortunate to have them with us. I know that everyone listening and watching will gain a better perspective on what we can all do to help ourselves and those who are suffering. My first guest, Dr. Jennifer Ashton, has become a good friend who shares my mission to ensure that everyone in emotional pain is able to seek and receive the care they deserve. In addition to being a well-respected New York physician, author, and chief medical correspondent for ABC, she's also known for speaking on behalf of women's health issues. In 2017, Jennifer suffered the devastating loss of her ex-husband, the father of her two children. She's written a book about her experience called Life After Suicide. We sat down together on a rainy day in New York City to talk about her book, why she chose that particular title, the lessons she has learned, and her passion to help others who are hurting. So I'm here in New York City today with this beautiful backdrop. It's a rainy day. I'm here with my good friend, Dr. Jennifer Ashton. Jen, thank you for joining me today, for taking time out to come and have a chat about our inner space. Thank you.
You know, Barbara, I would come anywhere in any weather to talk to you about anything, including this important topic.
Thank you.
So it's a pleasure.
So our viewers and our listeners will know you and your important work from Good Morning America, where you are the chief medical correspondent for Good Morning America and ABC. And there's a number of other places that you do that great work. And that would be reason enough to bring you to this wonderful series to talk about the importance of understanding our inner space and paying attention to it. But unfortunately, there is another reason that brought you into this space, the mental health space, that led to us meeting and to an amazing book that is just coming out. So before we talk about the book, Life After Suicide, I want to talk about how we met. A mutual friend connected us right around the time that we were hosting our second global summit on mental health culture change in London. And I invited you to come, and you came, and you were amazing.
Thank you. And the summit was amazing.
Thank you. But I want people to know you did one of the most powerful sessions for our summit in London, and it was on influencers.
Right.
People who are using their voice, their platform, their stories to change the culture of mental health. And for anyone who wants to see that wonderful session, they can go to changedirection.org and watch you. So why did you agree to come?
I think why I was so compelled to go, and this has to do with how you and I met, is that as a doctor, and I still have my own practice as a gynecologist, so I see women dealing with anything that affects them from head to toe.
Absolutely.
Because as you and I know, most women only see their gynecologist as their primary care doctor or healthcare provider. And so I hear about everything. I hear about their anxiety, their depression, their families, their jobs, anything that is affecting their lives. And then what I do for ABC is obviously cover any health or medical story that the country is interested in or that's happening in the news. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing this for over 10 years mm-hmm. in television. So I have talked about literally everything, including mental health and psychiatric disease, psychological issues. It didn't, like so many people can say this. You know, you can have oncologists who treat cancer every day, but until they themselves experience it, they don't have that perspective. And unfortunately, it took the biggest tragedy pretty much imaginable for me to have the change in perspective that I have now on mental health. And it was when my children's father and my very recently ex-husband mm-hmm. Ended his life by suicide in February of 2017. And it came completely out of the blue. And
I'm so sorry. I know.
Barb, thank you.
How you know, incredibly devastating it is for a family. And we're going to talk about what yeah. you've done with that. But I'm so
thank
sorry.
You. Before I tell you and your listeners about how it affected me and how it changed my perspective, I really want to just spend a few seconds, if that's okay,
sure.
really telling people about Rob, and because he was also a physician.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we met in 1995 when he was a resident and I was applying to medical school. And he dedicated his life to helping people. And in a way that is all too common, unfortunately, not just amongst physicians, but amongst anyone. He was unable to ask for help himself.
Mm-hmm.
But I know without a question that he would want this issue and even his life and his story to be a vehicle for helping other mm-hmm. people. And I am beyond proud. Proud is too small of a word and too shallow of an emotion when I say I'm beyond proud of our children, Alex and mm-hmm. Chloe, because they took what is really the worst thing imaginable for any child to go through, losing a parent to suicide. And almost intuitively, and I believe because of their father's spirit mm-hmm. of being a healer,
mm-hmm.
decided that they were not going to make this a secondary tragedy by becoming angry and bitter at the world, and that they were sensitive, kind, empathetic people before,
mm-hmm.
but they have just taken that to a new level, and they were involved in the book. They felt very strongly about my doing the book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I would have had the courage to do it without them next to me, not behind me, supporting my using the platform that I have to really speak to the tremendous amount of pain and suffering that so many people are experiencing, and they're experiencing it in the shadows and in silence. Even, by the way, celebrities, as
Absolutely.
You know. So it doesn't matter whether someone is famous, whether they have a lot of financial resources. When your life is affected by suicide, it doesn't discriminate.
It's
equal opportunity.
Right?
Exactly. It's
Sadly.
A great equalizer. Yeah.
So several things in that I want to back up to. One about your husband and that you mentioned he was a physician. He was a healer. And my guess is that you would say 100% if someone else had been suffering, he would have been there to help them, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
He would
sure.
have reached out. He would have tried to do whatever he could.
Definitely.
To help someone else.
The first time I spoke about this publicly, Barbara, I spoke about it with my colleague, George Stephanopoulos
yes.
on Good Morning America.
Got a huge public response,
which was,
right?
Yeah, massive.
Yes.
And it was
positive.
100% positive.
Yes.
And it was following Kate Spade's suicide.
Yes.
And I had told my colleagues at Good Morning America that the only way I would agree to talk about Kate Spade and suicide in general, or my experience, or that of my family, is if I were just speaking as a regular person mm-hmm. who's been living through this, not as the quote-unquote ABC News chief medical correspondent, because I'm not an expert in this field. You are mm-hmm. by training and by practice. I'm just living through this process.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I was only a year and 3 months into this process. So By no means did I feel like I was in a position to give anyone advice. Mm-hmm. What I did feel with the tremendous support of my children and my ABC family was that I was in a position to, if I could muster the strength to do it, just speak about what we had been going through so that people understand something that it's impossible to understand unless you're kind of sitting on the inside of it. Mm-hmm. And that's that kind of ripple effect that suicide leaves in its wake. I think that as a doctor who had been married to a doctor, we in the medical profession, you know this as a psychologist, we tend to think, you know, in some ways that we can help anyone going through anything, but sometimes we can't help ourselves. For me, I only realized after my ex-husband's death, and by the way, we had been amicably divorced for 2 weeks when he took his life, with no prior history of mental illness. Mm-hmm. And
so the suffering and the pain that was there was not evident.
Not really.
In the way that someone might have said, oh, this person is definitely,
No, definitely not.
In your story, and this is important, you, in hindsight, were able to see, oh, maybe this was an, but there was no, as you said, no clear, dramatic indication.
No, correct. And what I learned in, I hate to use the word journey because I feel like it's overused today, but I do feel like it is a journey.
Yep.
In what's gone on since his death is that for me, and I hope / think for my children as well, although they're not children anymore, they're 19
young
and
adults,
20,
yes.
So they're young adults and they can and do speak for themselves. But I think for us, one of the most important things that we have all realized after Rob's death is that if as people we don't become comfortable with our flaws and our weaknesses and
our pain,
fears
right?
and our pain, then you can't survive on this planet. And that's the one lesson that I think we have, all three of us, have learned in retrospect and in going forward. And in the book, it was very difficult for me, but necessary. And it happened kind of spontaneously where I had to, I use a line in the book that I don't want to spoil, be a spoiler here, or as we say in the business, bury the lead. But it really does in one sentence describe this concept, which I think is so important to share with people, which is that when Rob died, I felt like I was a plate, a porcelain plate that had been shattered into, you know, zillions pieces, right?
Yes.
And to put that plate back together again, every piece had to be glued back together, not just the pretty ones, not just the ones with the smooth edges, not just the ones that easily fit back together. And for me, that's the visual metaphor for understanding my fears, my pain, my weaknesses, my flaws, all of those things that we all live with. They're part of normal life and being here. You know this as a PhD and as a psychologist, but
to hear you say it so articulately and elegantly, these are elements of the human condition. And we humans have this desire, this need, this discomfort, and we try to segment that, don't we?
Right. And I was very good at that, Barbara. I was very good at that. It was one of my coping mechanisms to strive for, you know, high level achievement, perfection, whatever you want to call it. And I got it. I mean, if I wanted another degree, I got it. Mm-hmm. If I wanted to go to an Ivy League medical school, I went. And
which is all great. It's a good ability, right? But the balance.
But I guess for me, what that did, while it was positive on a lot of levels, as you said, it kind of did one of these. look over here, Jen. Mm-hmm. Look at all this good stuff you're doing. And don't look over there. Mm-hmm. Don't look over there at that painful stuff. Don't look over there at the stuff that you feel vulnerable with. And it's ironic, but having the very public media role that I have, you know, my ex-husband's suicide was a national story. I felt at that point, first of all, incredibly protective of my children because they're not national figures. And even though they were 17 and 18, you know, any parent's role is to protect their children. And I already had felt like I had failed at that because, you know, as a mother, you try to protect your children from pain.
From everything, right?
And clearly they were in pain when they lost their father. So I had to kind of juggle, how was I going to go back to work in the public, very public eye with everyone kind of knowing about this? How was I going to help my children heal? How was I going to heal? And it wasn't until that GMA segment with George about Kate Spade with the massive positive response that I got from people that I realized it wasn't me over here and everyone else over there. It was all of us together going through a lot of pain and suffering, but also healing.
Yes.
And growth.
Yes.
And was able to kind of put all the glue together, I guess.
And that led to your decision to, in fact, write this book. I love the way, the style, your voice in the book, because it is such a natural, just as if we're talking right here.
Yeah.
Was that a conscious decision to write it in that voice, or
that's the only way I could have written it. I think, you know, in the title, it's uses the three C's, community, comfort, and courage. And I think the way that I think the authenticity was born in the book is through community. Mm-hmm. Because in the book, part of the criteria I had when HarperCollins approached me to write this book is that it wouldn't just be my story and our story, but the story of other survivors as well. Mm-hmm. So I interviewed almost a dozen people, both celebrity and everyday people of all stages in their recovery and healing from suicide, all relatives, all different types of connections, some friends. And I didn't know these people before. These were all people that I sought out in the writing of this book. Hmm. And they gave me courage. Mm. That community gave me courage to be authentic with my experience and my story and my feelings. And I wouldn't have had that courage without the community.
And that comes across. What comes across so beautifully is how you captured their stories. And how their stories inspired you.
Totally. Totally.
So this book is not just for people who have been touched by, I started to say for all of us, because as you know, my husband's father took his own life. And many of my friends, and as a mental health professional, this has been a part of my experience. And so it is for all of us. We were talking before we began rolling the tape that, you know, used to be people would say, if you've been touched by, but now it's impossible find someone.
Right.
So I think that people will be inspired. I think people will get courage. I think people will understand the power and the importance of authenticity and finding people you can share. The other thing that I think people will get from this, which is so important, is that this is, whatever you want to call it, journey, process, whatever. It isn't a, now I feel all of this, and now I'm okay.
Oh, no, no. I think it's learning and living.
Yes.
And part of why I chose the title, Life After Suicide, is because life and living continue after these tragedies. And it's for anyone who, in all of the people that I know and that have spoken to, and I know you can say the same thing, when you lose someone to suicide, as my therapist told me, it's a different type of death. It's yes. a different type of grief.
Yes.
And for anyone, I don't care whether you're a friend, an acquaintance, a friend of a friend, a relative. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. When you think of that person and the way they lived their life and the way you are living yours and want to live yours going forward, I think that's where I find the psychological and emotional and intellectual process of connecting those dots really, really important. And as a medical professional, it's no longer acceptable to say, well, if I don't have cancer, I don't really need to pay attention to the cancer right. stories. Or if I don't have mental illness in my family, I don't need to pay attention to that. And I'm ashamed to say that as a doctor, even though, Barbara, three close people to me died by suicide, mm-hmm. including the physician sister of one of my best friends, who was also married to a physician who took her life 6 months before Rob did. Mm-hmm. And so my best friend and I, two doctors, have been going through this process almost in parallel. And to kind of open up our minds and our hearts to all of the feelings that this evokes in us, in others, and share in that process has been, I mean, I can't describe it really. I hope the book helps a lot of people going through, you know, what we're going through.
I have no doubt that it will. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because I think it's something that I feel is very important, and I want to get your perspective on it, because you're a physician and because of the type of healing and care you provide to women. I was thinking about pain,
mm-hmm.
and I was thinking about helping people understand who are listening, who maybe have gone through a loss by suicide, have experienced mental health challenges. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit, Jen, about the difference in how we humans experience different kinds of pain.
The two things that I think are so important about what you just mentioned, and you could put pain in somewhat the same category as stress, right? We know medically and psychologically there can be positive stress and there can be negative stress. I think you can say the same thing about not just physical pain in the example you gave, or take an athlete, for example. They have experienced physical pain all the time,
mm-hmm.
and it takes them to a higher level, right? Mm-hmm. Pain with training, pain mm-hmm. with soreness, pain, okay? I think you can also say the same thing about some types of emotional pain, for sure. I think, and I'm going to quote my daughter, Chloe, in something that she has said publicly. So it's not a private, statement or feeling for her, but very soon after Rob's death, she was 17 at the time. She said, "Mom, you know what this has done to me, for me, is that now when I hear someone say, oh, this is the worst day ever, you know, my boyfriend broke up with me, or my girlfriend broke up with me, or I didn't do well on a test," her reaction is, really, is it the worst day ever, though? Because mm-hmm. on my worst day, my father ended his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that perspective is an example,
mm-hmm.
and there are physical analogies to that too, right? I mean, when you've had a baby,
right.
naturally, or a kidney stone, and I've had three.
Ooh. Yeah.
You can say, okay, this hurts, but it doesn't hurt like that.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I think you can say the same thing for emotional and psychological pain.
Mm-hmm.
So that perspective and context, I think in that way, in some ways, it has made my children stronger
mm-hmm.
because they have lived and survived and are healing and are recovering in a very positive way. Mm-hmm. And for them, they will always have that context of, yeah, this is pretty bad, but I've lived through worse.
Yes. And why do you think, because I think that is so important for our listeners to hear as a takeaway, and why do you think that we as a human being,
we don't want to go there.
And we don't want to acknowledge that that kind of pain can be, you ask any veteran who survived combat, and maybe was shot to bits and also has post-traumatic stress, and you ask them which is worse, they will say the post-traumatic stress, the psychological pain, and yet we don't as a society like to acknowledge
that. And I'm not by any means trying to suggest that people with psychological pain should feel all rosy about it. But I do think there is the angle, the perspective, the context, however you want to look at it, that it can be a positive, but in that it can be debilitating and deadly, just like some physical pain can be, in my opinion, and as you said, even sometimes worse than physical pain, is when it's not addressed. And that, to me, you know, in my specialty, I have to tell a lot of women of all ages that they have a sexually transmitted infection. No one likes to hear that news, ever. And crying is very common, you know, shame and blame and anger and fear, all the same things that we I lived through that am still feeling on days, you know, that we hear with mental illness. And what I tell them is, you're not alone. I start quoting, oh, guess how many people in the United States have genital herpes? Guess how many people get this? Guess how many people get that? And all of a sudden, that's the sea. That's the community. They feel, I'm not alone.
Yes.
They already feel better.
And it helps them deal with it on a number of levels, right?
And then I think it's the having someone, a professional like you, a friend, a family, whomever, a community, that you can say, you're not alone. I know how you're feeling, and you're not alone. Mm-hmm. And we are going to get through this. You are going to get through this. And one of my patients who's 75 and she has two PhDs and she's very spiritual, as am I, she told me after Rob died, she said, Jen, I'm an older woman. I have wisdom that you don't have just because I've been on the planet for 75 years. And I will tell you that the goal of life is not to avoid pain. No one gets through life without experiencing pain if they are thinking and feeling. Only if they put themselves in a sterile environment, which is not real living, can you not have pain. She said, the goal of life is not to avoid pain. It's to process it and live through it. And I do believe in a spiritual way, not something we learn in medical school, not something that probably you learned when you were getting your PhD, that there can be a peace in dealing with emotional and physical pain, but it's not easy to find that. And there, unfortunately, is not a lot of support in trying to find it. And I hope that's changing. And I know with your voice and your mission, that is happening. I hope the book does the same thing in some small way. But it has changed my view on pain because, again, I tried to avoid that.
Right.
And I was doing a pretty good job until I had no choice but to confront it.
Yes. Well, I have no doubt that the book is going to help. And your speaking out is helping, is touching people. I would love for you to come back. I know we're
going to
work together between now and then.
Yeah.
But let's talk again after the book has been out a while and you are hearing from people, because you and I agree on this. It is about community.
Yeah.
It is about helping people understand that we are all in this together and that we can support each other through healing and pain and recovery and joy. So thank you, Jen, for coming.
Thank you, Barb.
It's wonderful to, always wonderful to see you.
Always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
I want to thank Dr. Jennifer Ashton for being so honest about her experience, her pain, and her healing. Our lives are always dramatically affected by the unexpected loss of a loved one. But loss from suicide can create additional feelings of guilt and shame for those left behind that can be damaging and destructive. Jennifer's book is a gift to our communities. It will help people heal from this devastating loss. She and I agree that by sharing our stories, we can provide comfort to one another, we can nurture one another, and we can overcome the cultural barriers that often lead so many of us to feel hopeless and despondent. One population that has been significantly affected by a rise in suicide over the last decade is our military and veteran communities. Our listeners may be familiar with the statistic that every day 20 of our veterans take their own lives. My next guest has spent her career searching for answers and developing strategies to save the lives of those who serve our country. I first met Dr. Keita Franklin years ago at an event for the Department of Defense Suicide Prevention Office, where I was immediately impressed by her willingness to think outside the box and her interest in collaboration as a strategy for caring for our servicemen and women and their families. Dr. Franklin comes from a social work background, but her passion for taking care of the families who serve our country is personal. Keita's father served in the military, and she is a military spouse herself. We sat down in Washington, D.C. to talk about her work, how far we've come toward our mutual goal of providing care for those who serve, and how far we have yet to go. We're here today in Washington, D.C., and I'm with Dr. Keita Franklin from the Department of Veterans Affairs, who is a tremendous leader in this space and a very dear friend. Thank you, Keita, for agreeing to stop in and talk a little bit about our inner space.
Thank you for having me.
Where were you when you had your first experience with suicide, and because obviously somewhere along the line you began to do this work as a career?
I was at McCord Air Force Base in Washington State at a time when they would have one social worker go up in a movie theater, and they would bring in like hundreds of troops, and you would have this homemade slideshow that you had developed yourself on risk factors for suicide. It was one of these things where the commander would call you and say, "Look, Keita, you're going to go. You're going to give this brief."
Had they had a suicide?
No, they had not had a suicide, but it was their annual requirement. Okay. And they were just going to, thank goodness we don't do training this way anymore, I will tell you. So I was at the theater and I went up with my slides and I gave this brief, and relatively young social worker. And afterward, a few people came over to talk to me, and this enlisted female airman came up and shared with me, she just came right up to me and said, "You know, I resonated with your presentation, and I happened to be saying something in the talk about trauma, mm-hmm. how trauma can be a risk factor." And I said nothing about a specific type of trauma, but trauma. And she said, "I was sexually assaulted when I first joined the Air Force."
Wow.
And tears started coming down, and she said, "Over the years, it comes back to me. I've not spoke to anybody about it. And I do sometimes think there's no way out."
Oh, so sad.
Of that experience.
But
yes,
so good that she shared with you.
Yes, it was after class that she came and waited around and spoke with me. We were able to get her into mental health care and start talking about that. But ironically, she was probably in her 40s, and the assault had occurred
in her 20s.
Yes, very, very early in her life. So that was my first experience. And then over the years, I just got into it more and more. I've always stayed on the literature, on studying, you know, what is it? A little bit, fascinated is not the right word, but it's a really complex issue.
Yes. And a lot of people don't understand that. You and I have talked about that. People, understandably, people want a solution, an answer. You and I have talked about there is no one solution, one answer. There's not even a, okay, we can develop a test and I'll give it to Keita and I'll know whether she's going to feel suicidal or take her own life. And I could give one to somebody else who it looked like they had no indications, but something may happen and they end up, right?
Like biomarker. People will ask about that. Is there a biomarker? Could we just screen people better? If only we took a better assessment when they were 18, or if only there's no score, there's no math. So,
and you know what I think?
It's so complex.
And I want to know if you share this or have a different reaction. I think it's because it is so painful for someone to lose a loved one, anytime, of course. But when someone chooses to end their life, the collateral damage, the ripple effects around that for the family, for the community, people want answers, they want to solve. It's so powerful, so painful. What do you see?
Yes, I completely agree with you. And the survivors, I worry about them at times because they do feel so much of the responsibility of it.
Yes.
We've been pushing recently in the VA about it's a systems issue and there's no one to blame.
Yes.
I mean, certainly we are responsible for the program, but it is a complex issue, and it's not the spouse's fault.
Right.
It's not mom and dad's fault.
Or the unit's fault.
They will
say,
we had a fight in the days leading up to the suicide, and they'll call you and tell you these, and I never miss an opportunity to talk to a survivor too. And when they share those stories, you just want them to not feel the burden and the pain of that. Because it was not that last.
No. It's like when we were young and we learned, well, Keita and I are still young, just so you know. But when we were young and we learned as young clinicians, asking someone, are you suicidal,
yes,
does not make someone suicidal.
Right.
And probably in our careers together, we've probably reiterated that thousands.
I could say it in my sleep, yep.
All the time.
It's a myth, yes.
But people are afraid. They're afraid of suicide. They're afraid I think a lot of people also don't understand that a lot of people have suicidal images, suicidal ideas, thoughts.
Yes.
That's a lot different than actually developing a plan or taking your life. There are different ways that people end their lives. Sometimes it's planned. Sometimes it's impulsive.
Yes.
So as you said, very complex, very important that we're having these conversations, which leads me to another question, which is, we're seeing some changes, aren't we, about things like even the language that people will say someone died by suicide.
Yes.
People are starting to talk differently, aren't they, about these issues?
Yes, I think so. I mean, one of the most important things, I think, is just making sure people talk about it with a sense of hope. And I see people doing that more recently than ever before. I've even, you know, had conversations with people that have been around the military sector for a long time, and they'll say, like, you might think there's a lot of stigma now, and there is, but mm-hmm. years back it was worse.
Mm-hmm.
So it has gotten better, and we are talking about it in a way of a sense of hope, a sense of prevention is possible. It's
yes.
not like the inevitable end.
Yes. And people are not born wired to take their own life.
Yeah, no, absolutely
and
not.
And so there's lots of places where we can intervene. One of the things that this show is all about is giving people hope, is helping people understand how we take care of our inner space, how we take care of the people we love, because there's, this is, I think, what I've believe, and obviously I'm an optimist. I wouldn't have launched a nonprofit organization.
Yes,
you got to be an optimist.
Your glass is always very full.
To do that, as is yours.
Yes.
But there is always hope.
Yeah.
And we're seeing some interesting things in the landscape. You know, there's a university, UCLA, has launched the Grand Depression Challenge. That's huge.
Yes.
That they're doing that. You know, when you look 5 years down the road, where would you like to see our country, our world, our support for veterans, for people who are in emotional pain? Where do you want us to be in 5 years?
Particularly veteran suicide, but I think it applies more broadly and nationally, is I think if we could think about suicide prevention and taking care of people, not just in hospital settings. And so to the extent that we can think about community-based work and prevention occurring in every square corner, in every square piece of the nation,
mm-hmm.
whether that's in employers, like we're really not going to prevent suicide, I don't think, in the long haul and have a sustained approach in a hospital setting alone.
I agree. It's too late.
Yes.
You're way too late.
Hospitals have made great advancements over
yes.
the years, and they're doing very good treatment.
Yes.
Gold standard, evidence-based. I mean, as you know, being in the field of psychology, we have advanced our treatment methods quite
absolutely.
Well from even early on in my career. But I think if we had a nation that was charged up with making sure that they knew the signs, the symptoms, how to reduce stigma, and a cultural change coupled with education and awareness across multiple sectors, that I think would change the national approach.
And we can get there,
can't
we? To
mental health and suicide. Yes.
We can get there.
I believe we can.
I
really do.
I do too.
I can see it. There are days when
yes,
I can see it.
I can
yes.
too.
I want to thank my guests, Dr. Jennifer Ashton and Dr. Keita Franklin, two women who are using their expertise and their experience to open conversations and create tools to reach those who are hurting and the families of those who have died by suicide. As Jennifer shared, it's nearly impossible to find someone whose life hasn't been affected by suicide. But it's women like Jennifer and Keita who are creating safe places to share and developing more tools to reach those in need. Before we close this episode, I want to remind everyone to pay attention to your emotional well-being and the well-being of those you love. If you become concerned about yourself, reach out for help to a trusted family member, a friend, or a healthcare professional. While we may not believe it during times of darkness and despair, there is always reason for hope. There are many treatments that bring relief and healing, and new approaches are being developed and discovered every day. And finally, if you're concerned about someone you love, don't be afraid to tell them what you see, and don't be afraid to ask them how they're doing. People often share with me that they're afraid that if they ask a loved one if they are considering hurting themselves, that somehow that will cause it to happen. But suicidal ideation and suicidal intent doesn't work that way. You can't make someone suicidal who isn't. Asking someone if they're worried about themselves may allow them to tell you that they need your help. If you'd like to join us in our efforts to change the culture of mental health, please participate in our upcoming A Week to Change Direction, June 9th through the 15th. Visit changedirection.org and dcpentertainment.com to see what other individuals and groups are doing. It's easy, and your effort may just save a life. Thank you for listening and for caring about your inner space. Once again, I want to thank my wonderful team from DCP Entertainment for making this show possible. Y'all can follow me on Twitter at B. Van Dalen. Please use hashtag InnerSpace on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. And please share your journey with us about emotional well-being.